Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio brings you Faith Alive, inspiring talks from the finest Catholic speakers. Today, from the 2019 Columbus Catholic Women's Conference, Father Christopher Hartley. Here's the MC, Anna Mitchell, with the introduction. Enjoy.
Now, I am delighted to introduce to you our second speaker, Father Christopher Hartley. Father Hartley is a missionary priest who seeks to serve Christ among the most needy. I sense a theme here with our speakers. He ministered to Haitian sugarcane workers in the Dominican Republic from 1997 to 2006. For 13 years, he served the Hispanic population in the Bronx, and he has worked for many years with the Missionaries of Charity, of course, the Sisters of Mother Teresa. Today, he's ministering in Ethiopia. Father Hartley founded the Mission of Mercy Foundation, and its goal is to improve the lives of the most vulnerable people through programs and projects developed in accordance with the principles of the Catholic Church. The teaching of the Word of God and the comfort it brings to those most in need lies at the heart of everything the foundation does. The foundation works in the poorest countries of the world, promoting health and education in local parishes. Thank you so much for being here, Father Hartley.
I announce to you Jesus Christ. He is the truth, the life to be lived, the bread that has come down from heaven, and the living water. He is the resurrection and the light of the world. This is for the only reason that the church exists in the world, to proclaim Jesus Christ and to bear witness to his name, to make present in every corner of the world the salvation won for us on Calvary and his victory, which we celebrate in the Paschal Mystery. To proclaim Jesus Christ to the ends of the world is the reason for which each one of us here has been baptized, has been called by name, has been consecrated, and has been sent. How well we would do to ask ourselves, if I really believe that God knows my name and that he calls me every day by that name and that he calls me at all times, at every moment of my life, that I have been anointed by his Spirit and that the power of that Spirit is at work always in my life and that I have been sent. That each one of us exists for this purpose and for this purpose alone. That if I don't live this calling, this consecration, and this missio, this being sent forth, my life simply has no meaning. We realize that this has happened to us, as St. John of the Cross likes to say, the great Spanish mystic, because the gaze of God is love. His call, his gaze, is his declaration of love to me in this very moment of my existence. I exist because you loved me. St. Paul, writing to the Ephesians, says, God chose us in Christ before the world was made to be holy and blameless in his sight through love. Before a little bird flew in the air, before there were mountains and oceans, before the world was made, God chose each one of us by name for a purpose, to be holy and blameless in his sight through love. There are those who believe that when they were born, they were given a blank music sheet for them to write the tune, the melody, the life of their choice. Those who understand that life is a sequence of choices that I am free to make with no accountability to God or man. There could be many of us here who, when we look back and we look at our lives, ask ourselves, but what has happened in my life? These were my choices. And there are those who were born in the belief that God had already written the melody, the music, the tune of their lives, and that to live is not to be the best composer, but to live is to have the wisdom to interpret that melody that He, from all eternity when He chose us, had written for each one of us. The best musician is not the one who composes Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It is already composed. The best musician is the one who can most faithfully interpret the music that was written. When we look at our lives, we realize that many times we have been our own composers, that we left aside the melody, the music, the song that was written for us, and we chose a different tune. We deviated from that music sheet that God had written for me, and for me alone, with an unrepeatable love. That melody, that music from which I deviated, is my call to conversion. Many of us will have the opportunity, I already did a few minutes ago, to have the opportunity to go to confession, which means to recognize I have been writing my own music, doing my own sweet will, asking for God's help, instead of asking myself, what did you write for me? Conversion, therefore, means to return to the melody which He had written for me from all eternity. Each one of us has the opportunity to return to the original music sheet written for us. There is only, in the final analysis, one person who has never deviated from that music sheet, which is the Blessed Virgin Mary. The one who, in fidelity to Jesus Christ, her Son, even in her womb, at the moment of conception, can say yes, and clearly not understanding. Twice we read in the Gospel of St. Luke that it says, they did not understand. To be faithful to what is written when I don't understand. And He went down with them to Nazareth, and He was obedient to them. They did not understand, and Mary kept all these things in her heart. It was the morning of Christmas of 1976, a cold morning in Madrid, and with the rest of my family, except my mother, we were gathered around the Christmas tree, and we were opening our gifts. It was the first Christmas that my mother was not with us because a close relative of hers was very close to death and she needed to be there. And though it was Christmas Day, a very happy time in my childhood, I miss my mother terribly. And I was already a seminarian. I had entered the seminary at age of 15, and I was opening the gifts, and suddenly I realized that I was opening a gift which was from my father. My father was Anglican. My father was English. My mother is Spanish. We are Catholic because my mother was Catholic. And my father had given me a book. I well remember that book. It's still on a shelf in my mother's home, called Mother Teresa, Her People and Her Work. As I said, I was already a seminarian. And when I opened that book and I saw those horrific photographs of the misery and the suffering of the poorest of the poor, the wretched of the world, the refuse of humanity, that those missionaries of charity were touching, and I was looking at those photographs, I could see the eyes of God looking at me. And when I saw those photographs, I said nothing to anyone. As I've said, I was already on the way to the priesthood in my early years of formation. I remember as if it was this very moment that I said to myself in the silence of my heart, for the rest of my life, this is who I want to be and what I want to do. The first opportunity that I had, which was the following summer of 1977, I went to work with the Missions of Charity in London, and Mother Teresa came, and that's where I met her for the first time. One of the most unforgettable moments of my life. One wonders how someone so holy in such little time can have such a profound effect on the heart of a young man. I am sure she said many things to me in that brief encounter, but two things I have never forgotten, because she wrote them on a holy picture, on a holy card. She said, "Be holy and love the poor." I have never forgotten that. And she bid me farewell with an invitation, come to India, come to Calcutta. And so I did. The following summer, I went to work with her Missionaries of Charity for every spare minute of my summer holidays in the seminary. And as I was in the home for the dying in Kalighat, near Malkhridai, working with her sisters, especially the novices, they brought this man from the street, covered from head to toe in maggots, a walking skeleton, well, a lying down skeleton on a stretcher. And he was placed on this little platform where it was written on the wall with Mother Teresa's own handwriting. It said, "The body of Christ," that you would remember that when you would remove the rags of the bodies of the dying men and women brought to that home, you would never forget that what you were touching that morning was the same Jesus Christ whom you had received at Holy Mass in Holy Eucharist. Very slowly, very gently, we removed the maggots, bathed this man's body who was clearly in his last breath, and placed him on a cot with all the rest of the dying. And as we did, unfortunately, it was time to go home for lunch. The famous Sister Luke, who had been in charge of that home for the dying for so many years, sent us all away for lunch and would not listen to my desire to stay on close to that man until he would die, because I was sure that when I returned in the afternoon, he would be gone. And I was sent away. I had lunch. I rushed back on those trams as fast as I could. And when I came into the home for the dying that afternoon, to my amazement, he was still alive. And I went straight to the cot, very low off the ground. He looked at me. There was an Indian sister standing next to me. And he stretched out his hands toward me. I took them in my own. And he said in Bengali, "I have been waiting for you." And he died. Those words still resound deep in my heart, deep in my brain. Because this is what so many millions and millions of people are saying to the church today. "I have been waiting for you." Someone dying in the flesh or dying in the spirit is saying to us, "I am waiting for you." It is wonderful to hold this conference with so many thousands of you. But you have no idea what it means to me as a priest that in the little time that I have spent, I'm even now seeing on the back wall more priests than I have ever seen in my last 12 years in Africa, because the nearest Catholic priest to me is almost 600 miles away. Because I live alone, pray alone, celebrate Mass alone, day after day. I have distributed more Holy Communions this morning than I've probably done in the last 4 or 5 years. I live on the border with Somalia, where the Catholic Church has never been present. From the day the Word was made flesh, Mass had never been celebrated in the place where I live, G-O-D-E, Gode. You can look it up on Google Earth, Gode, Ethiopia, and you will know the place, on the banks of a river called the Wabi Shebele, where 100% of the people, just about, are Muslim, fanatic Muslim. It's very possible that to none of you the name Antonio Cesar Fernandez, does that name ring a bell? I wouldn't think so. Well, Antonio Cesar Fernandez was a Salesian missionary who was murdered yesterday in Burkina Faso. A Salesian. 50 years a missionary. You can look it up. It's on some of the religious web pages. Do you think that this man's name, 50 years in Africa, is going to be on the front page of a newspaper? Do you think Antonio Cesar Fernandez is going to make headlines, not even in our religious web pages? But just you wait for a priest to fall, and you will see his name in black gold letters. Fifty years of a man's life is probably more than many of you have ever lived. By the time you were born, he was already in Africa. How many masses would that be? How many baptisms? How many miles of dirt roads? And who will remember him? In 2013, I was in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, preaching a retreat to the missionaries of charity. And on the last day of retreat, before I went to the airport to return back to Africa, I was told of two sisters whom I had met, two missionaries of charity, who were buried in the adjacent cemetery. The sisters themselves, from their own congregation, told me very matter of fact. So I walked over to the cemetery, thinking it was a tiny little place next to their chapel. But to my surprise, it was a gigantic cemetery. And I, after saying a few prayers before the remains of these sisters at their tombstones, I began to wander into that cemetery. And I had no idea that that was the cemetery for missionaries. Name after name after name, from every country in Europe, from the United States. By the way, many Holy Cross priests who were missionaries in Bangladesh, the same ones that you have at Notre Dame. 18th century, 19th century, name after name, a date of birth and a date of death. People who left everything, family, home, parents, you name it. And there they were, buried in that cemetery. Remembered by whom? That no one to say a prayer or to bring some flowers? Families that were left behind in faraway countries to which you would never return. The last two letters that St. Francis Xavier wrote to St. Ignatius arrived in Rome several months after he had died. When they said goodbye, they said goodbye forever. Unfortunately, I realized that that original calling that had brought me to the missions and where I had spent by then, at the invitation of Mother Teresa, 8 years in the South Bronx, serving primarily the Hispanic community. Unfortunately, those grand ideals of my youth as a seminarian and early years in the priesthood had very subtly, and God forbid this should happen to any one of you, had become ambitions. I was sent to Rome to do a PhD at the Gregorian University, and John Carlo O'Connor kept saying to me, you're going to be this and you're going to be that, and I ended up believing it. Of course, always for the service of the church. What happened to the ideals of the youth of a young priest? But not being at peace with myself, I went on a retreat. I was by then the pastor of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral in Lower Manhattan, the first cathedral of New York, which was now a regular parish. And that dilemma of the poorest of the poor, Mother Teresa, the home for the dying, the I will dedicate myself for the rest of my life to this, all those ideals now turned into ecclesiastical ambitions. So I went to the cardinal, not for any noble reason. It's because I was so sure that the cardinal would never give me permission to become a missionary that I wanted to ask for permission in order for him to say no and me put my conscience with my God at peace. I wanted to be a missionary, but I am so priceless to the Archdiocese of New York . So, there I was, more or less 10 o'clock in the morning on May 16th, standing on Madison Avenue for my appointment, which was a simple formality, to go back to my parish. And everything was very carefully choreographed, because when you really want something, you say it in a certain tone of voice. And when you don't want something, you begin the sentence by saying what I said. Your Eminence, you wouldn't give me permission, of course. to go down to the Dominican Republic at the invitation of a priest friend of mine that kept nagging me. And he looked at me and he said these words that how could I forget? Remember that His Eminence John Cardinal O'Connor is the founder of the Sisters of Life. And he said to me, Christopher, I had other plans for you. But far above any plans that I as a bishop have for you are the plans of God. Go to the Dominican Republic. No. Wait. Let's do this again. This is the part where you say you have to go back to St. Patrick's Old Cathedral. Long story short, I was in a daze, standing in the middle of Madison Avenue, with half of the world going on one direction and the other, bumping into me, and I had to be a missionary. And I went down to the Dominican Republic. I arrived in a parish that had been without a priest for 10 years. And nobody had told me except that it was a pretty poor place in the province of San Pedro de Macorís, that most of my parish was made up of sugarcane fields. And within the first 2 or 3 days, this Brazilian sister working in that diocese came to my residence and said, Father, you better be very sure, since you're obviously unaware of the situation here, that it is forbidden for the church to enter the Vicini, is the name of the family, the Vicini sugarcane plantations. Don't you dare go into those plantations because they can kill you. And then I started saying, but where am I? I had no idea what sugarcane looked like. I came straight off the streets of Lower Manhattan. I had no idea where human rights came from, because I took mine for granted. I never even thought about them. And the only time I had felt my human rights abused was when my parents never gave me permission to do something, and I would say, that's not fair. And that was just about the extent of the violation of my human rights. Until one day, this young Haitian, very poor, came to my house and said after 3 months, and you're never going to come and say Mass for us? It was like a knife had pierced my heart as a priest. So, absolutely terrified, packed a Mass kit and went to the nearest of the little villages dispersed within the gigantic sugarcane fields so that the escape route back to the parish could be easiest. And in fear and tremble, under a mango tree, I still remember, these hamlets were called Batei, I celebrated that first Mass. I can never forget the faces of those Haitian people, how they sang from the bottom of their hearts, how they prayed with such love and such devotion, how they sang and sang and sang, how they had prepared that altar, a rickety table with a bedsheet for an altar cloth. And I cannot forget that the plastic flowers they had put on that table, one was on a can of tomato paste and the other in a whiskey bottle. But I don't think I have ever celebrated Mass in a more worthy place to more extraordinary people. Except at the end of the Mass, maybe about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I asked them, and today, what have you had to eat? And they said, nothing yet. And with that, I got in my car in my four-wheel drive Land Rover and back to the mission. And I said to myself, so I eat three square meals. I have a very nice house. I come in this very nice vehicle to the plantations, and now I leave. And they call me father. And they have had nothing to eat. They're not paid in cash. Children sow the sugarcane fields from the age of 4 and 5 to the tune of 25 cents of a dollar per furrow. They have no access to medical care. Children don't go to school. There is no electricity. I could see the oxen that pull the sugarcane carts drinking from the same water faucets that the people were drawing water to bring to the homes, where there was no difference between an animal and these laborers and their families. And that was my parish. And those were the people entrusted to my care. Those were the people who from 79, Calcutta, to 97, the Dominican Republic, were re-echoing across the oceans and the continents the words of that dying man in Calcutta. We have been here waiting for you. I remember Sonia, a little girl who never played. And I went up to her. I said, Sonia, why are you always sitting and you never played? Nobody really knew that Sonia had HIV and her body was covered in scars. And when I asked her why she always wore the same broken dress with a torn zipper on the back, she says, because I cannot take the dress off. And I said, what? So I went up to her and I tried to very gently remove the hem of the dress. And I realized that the dress was stuck to her body, that the sores, the pus, that the blood of her wounds had attached the dress to her skin. What was written in that home for the dying came so alive to me, the body of Christ, the same body that I broke every morning on the altar, was the same body that I was touching for the rest of the day in the lives of my parishioners. The confrontation with this family, the political support that they received from the government, and sad to say also from the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, to which they were very, very generous, had silenced the voice of the Church. Because it is so easy to forget that it is very, very difficult, to almost say impossible, to preach the gospel to the rich whose money you need to run your church. I cannot tell them that what they are doing is wrong if I have to go 5 minutes later to say I need a check from them to run my hospitals and my schools. And the price that the church pays is silence. And the church was silent. And the church said nothing. And the church knew that this was happening. And the church looked the other way. And I realized that I was standing there in the middle of a sugarcane field with sugarcane to as far as my eyes could reach. And realized that these people had no other voice except mine, their parish priest. And that was what was written in my music sheet. How tempting it was at that moment to become a composer and not an interpreter. But God has his ways. And his ways meant that on January 31st, the president of the Dominican Republic at the time, Leonel Fernandez, came for some political rally to my parish. And in Catholic countries where the church is so powerful and so prominent, I was invited to give an invocation to welcome the president to the parish. I didn't have the years of experience that I had today. My innocence, my naivete, led me to think that I could say anything in his presence. So I consulted with the diocesan lawyer, and I said, I'm not going to this because I know I'm being used for some political advantage of a president who's done nothing for these people. But she, being a Dominican and herself born in one of these plantations, said to me, Father, you never know the opportunity that you will have to speak to the president. I went to bed, and after half an hour, woke up and sat down, and for the first time in my life, wrote a speech. And the speech to be delivered the next day replaced a prayer I never made. I took the advantage of the invitation of a short little prayer of blessing, an assurance that God was with him, to read a four-page speech to him that began with the words, Mr. President, whether you realize it or not, you have come to the threshold of hell. Please allow me to describe the living and working conditions of these people. The proof that the blessing of God has descended upon you is that you do something for these people. If you turn away and say empty words seeking their political support and don't do anything, God's blessings to you are of no use. I had completely miscalculated the consequences of my own words. I didn't realize that obviously the media of the country was there in front of me. I was so brave when I wrote that speech, but when I was standing about 10 feet from the president, I could literally feel that I was peeing in my pants. Not metaphorically, I assure you. Because how brave we are when the enemy is not in front of us and not close to us. The next day, in all the newspapers, news services, television programs, priest to president, and my life was never the same. And never the same year 2000 that led to my eviction in 2006 from the Dominican Republic. I was expelled by the Dominican government, and I was expelled by the Catholic Church. And I went home. My father was dying at that time, so I spent some time with him. I went to see the cardinal of my archdiocese in Toledo and basically said, I'm unemployed. I come from a diocese that has many missionaries, and missionaries in the diocese is a very normal reality, thank God. And I asked for permission to volunteer to go with the missionaries of charity anywhere in the world where the gospel had not been preached and where the sisters had not been able to open a house because of a lack of a priest. I couldn't care if it was Mongolia or Patagonia. Wherever the sisters had not been able to make the church present. And he gave me permission. I contacted the sisters in Calcutta, assuming that the Superior General and the first successor of Mother Teresa, Sister Nirmala, was there. And they said, oh, no. She's in Africa. Africa was never in my imagination, in the horizon of my vocation. She's in Ethiopia, and she's going to stay a long time there visiting the many houses we have in that country. So instead of going to India to meet her, I went to Ethiopia. I only went there to meet this woman. I didn't know that I was going to spend the next 12 years of my life there. As I was speaking with her in a parlor and the provincial sister, who basically were deciding my future between them without even asking me, I was staring at the wall behind them where there was a map of Ethiopia. It was then that I realized which were the neighboring countries, which to my embarrassment, I couldn't even name at that time. I didn't know that Kenya was in the south and Sudan to the west and Eritrea to the northeast and Somalia to the east. I didn't know that. And as I'm looking at that map, I see there are 17 pins on the map. But curiously, if I could draw a mental line down the middle of the map, I realized that there were no pins on the eastern part of the country. And I interrupted their conversation. I said, "Sister, by the way, why don't you have any houses to the right, to the eastern part of the country?" The provincial, the regional sister, Sister Benedicta from Germany, looked at me as if to say, "It's not possible that you could be so ignorant to know that it's not that we don't have houses, is that Christianity, the gospel, has never been preached in that part of Africa." When I heard the word never, I got up, I went to the map, as if I told you to look at the map of Togo, and within that huge area of never, to which she added, "Don't bother, Father, because it is impossible, never impossible," I saw the word G-O-D-E, underlined, bold, and with a little icon of an aeroplane. And I turned around, I looked at the sisters and said, "Gode." So we went that same afternoon to meet the Archbishop of Addis Abeba, and we presented the idea, which was met with an Ethiopian look of, "You are raving lunatics, because going to Gode and suicide is basically the same thing, but you don't say those things, not to me, little me, to missionaries of charity." And he got up, he sat at his computer, on his letterhead, wrote a letter with his signature and stamp and seal. And with that, I went back to Spain with a map of Ethiopia and a letter of request from the Archbishop of Addis. But when I was leaving Addis Abeba, the Archbishop said to me, "You have an obligation in conscience to tell your Archbishop that it is a very, very dangerous place." So, being scrupulous, and as already you've found out, a little manipulative with Colonel O'Connor, knowing that I had to say those words to the Archbishop, but looking for the right moment to say it so that I would assure, in this case, not the no, but the yes, to Ethiopia, I explained everything, and he was very enthusiastic. Colonel Cañizares, who subsequently became the prefect for divine worship in Rome, appointed by Pope Benedict XVI, and he said yes, and off I went, and as I got up and he gave me his triple blessing, complete hypocrite, pretending that I was just remembering at that moment, turned around when I was at a safe distance and said to the Cardinal, "Your Eminence, by the way, the Archbishop of Addis told me to tell you this was a very, very dangerous place," and saying inside, "Please don't say no, please don't say no, please don't say no." And he came up to me and he patted me on the back and he said, "All the more reason to pray for you." And with that letter of his and a map of Ethiopia, I showed up in the heart of the Somali region where Mass had never been celebrated. But never from the day the Word was made flesh. Every time I gave the sign of peace, I would look out of the little window in the rented house I was living in with no internet, no electricity, no running water. the ceiling, the floor, and the four walls. That was it. I would look out of the window and imagine in my missionary fantasy that I could see Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia. And I kept saying, "Peace with you, Somalia," without a congregation for 7 years. For 7 years, I said Mass every day on my own. The bishop of that diocese, it's called an apostolic vicariate because it's a mission territory. It is the same size of Italy, but there are only 14 priests, 9 million Muslims, 600,000 Orthodox Christians, 21,000 Catholics. 12 years later, we are, depending on the day, 6 to 8 Catholics on Sunday. As I said, I've given more communions today than I have for the rest of last year. But when they ask me, "What are you doing there? Why are you wasting your priesthood when there is so much to do in so many other places?" I always say, "I am here so that he can be here." Because when I leave that mission, as is the case at this moment, and please remember that tomorrow is Sunday, and you will all have Mass and a priest at your service, that little mission will be vacant because I am here with you. The last thing I do when I go to the airport, as I did the day before yesterday, to get on an airplane, well, 4 airplanes to come here, is remove the Blessed Sacrament from the tabernacle. When I am not there, nor is he. There are things, fortunately, that even in this day and age, you cannot buy with money. You cannot pay in cash. $1 million wouldn't celebrate one Mass or keep Christ in that tabernacle. There are millions and millions of people who have never heard the word Jesus. Never. They have not rejected him because they have never heard his name. And the only reason why they haven't heard his name is because no one has gone there. I met a priest, a very venerable missionary, who told me that he had been a missionary in the northern jungles of Thailand, a French missionary, with a colleague and a companion. They had gone together to these jungles, to these villages that had never had the gospel preached to them. After days and days and days of walking through the jungle, they come to this village and they ask the chief for permission to speak to the entire population. And they were peaceful people and they all gathered. And in simple words, they told the story of Jesus. Everybody listened in stone silence. And when they had finished, they were not very bright men, but full of love and full of zeal and full of enthusiasm, maybe not the greatest speakers or preachers, but they simply conveyed the kerygma of the gospel message. They asked if anybody had any questions. And finally, at the far end, a young man raised his hand and simply said, or asked, "All I want to say, if what you have told us about this Jesus is true, why has it taken you so long to come to tell us? Why are the 3,000 people here and nobody wants to go to be a missionary to people? I am sick and tired of hearing people say, 'No, my mission is here. No, you can be a missionary everywhere.' Well, that's wonderful. But how about somebody wanting to go to those places where never impossible? I would like to ask the bishops of the United States, for the sake of the country we're in, how many priests have come in the course of this one past year and knocking on their doors, on the doors of the bishops, to ask, would you give me permission to be a missionary? You know how many letters my bishop in the missions has filed of religious congregations to which we have written asking for sisters to come to my mission, and nobody wants to come? The answers are, they're pretty standard. We have no sisters. We're too old. Others, we're too young. Others, the sisters would be too afraid to go to those places. In the end, nobody wants to go. Nobody wants to go to those places. Nobody wants to go to the missions. And Christ is not preached. But you get on any airplane to go to Addis Abeba, and you will see how many American Protestant families are going to Addis Abeba, to Ethiopia, to preach the good news with their little lovely blonde children arriving in the missions. 20% of all of Ethiopia has become Protestant in the last 20 years. Of 120 million inhabitants, 20% of all of Ethiopia is now Protestant. The Catholics, who have been there for decades and decades, used to be 1% of the population, and now we're down to 0.5% of the population. And we're going to blame the Protestants? And finally, the neighboring town to where I went to evangelize is called Calafo. And we were there with a few volunteers who had come to help me over the summer doing some medical work. And I was called, they seemed to think that the priest knew about everything, to a mud hut, which was very dark, like the typical huts that you see on documentaries about Africa. And I went inside, I crunched through the door, through the entrance. It was completely dark, steaming hot, and full of women in their Muslim veils. And they were all weeping and very agitated, and they pushed me toward the end of the hut and showed me this horrible, miserable cot. I couldn't see very well, but I could tell there was a woman lying there. And as I came close and I pulled out my little flashlight, I saw and I looked into her face that she was very young. And then with my flashlight, saw her body under the rag she was covered with. And there was something moving at her feet. And there was a newborn baby that was dying, as the mother was dying. And the mother of this woman lying on that cot grabbed me by my clerical shirt and said to me in Somalinya, in Somali, do something. I conclude with what the poor of Calcutta or the poor of my Somali mission said to me, because this is what, in the name of the poorest of the poor, I have come to say to you as Catholic women. There are so many people saying to you this morning, I have been waiting for you. Please do something. In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Faith Alive is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio. You've been listening to Father Christopher Hartley from the 2019 Columbus Catholic Women's Conference. If you'd like to download a copy of Father Hartley's talk, please go to stgabrielradio.com and click on the special features page of our audio archive. Thanks for being with us today. God bless and have a great day.